KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. As the Trump administration faces dozens of lawsuits to block the president's many executive actions, some are asking the question, what happens if the president just ignores court rulings? That's ahead on Morning Edition from NPR News. The idea of the U.S. using more nuclear energy has bipartisan support. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez, but more nuclear energy means more nuclear waste. We visit a small town in Colorado considering becoming a temporary storage site. Also, in a world flooded by dating apps, would you ever consider going through a matchmaker? We talked to the host of the new show, Muslim Matchmaker. It's Tuesday, February 11th. Happy birthday to the woman who sings, "All I Wanna Do Is Have Some Fun." Yeah, singer-songwriter Sheryl Crow is 63 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Jordan's King Abdullah will be at the White House this morning to meet President Trump. This comes after Trump called for the U.S. to take over Gaza and for Jordan and Egypt to take in displaced Palestinians. NPR's Jane Araf reports from Amman.
The day before the White House meeting, Trump threatened Jordan with aid cuts if it didn't agree to the plan. Jordan, a key U.S. security partner, needs the aid provided by Washington. But according to former Foreign Minister Marwan Muasher, accepting Trump's plan would mean the country would cease to exist in many ways.
This is an existential issue to Jordan that does not lend itself to any economic pressure from the United States.
He points out that expelling Palestinians to Jordan would breach the peace treaty it signed with Israel 3 decades ago. And that this is a rare case where Arab countries, including powerful Saudi Arabia, are united in opposing it. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman, Jordan.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his country will respond firmly to steel and aluminum tariffs President Trump imposed yesterday. Dan Karpinchuk reports Trudeau says the 25% tariffs are unjustified and unacceptable.
Trudeau stopped short of committing to a dollar-for-dollar retaliation as he has for the now-paused import tariffs, but he says his government will stand up for Canadian workers and Canadian industries. Trudeau also says his government will be working with the Trump administration ahead of the tariffs coming into effect to point out how deeply integrated the U.S. and Canadian steel and aluminum markets are. They include defense, shipbuilding, and auto manufacturing. When Trump introduced similar tariffs in 2018, Canada retaliated during free trade negotiations before it received an exemption. Trudeau is in Paris working to strengthen Canada-EU trade ties as both face tariff threats from Washington. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
All work has stopped at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The agency's job is to make sure Americans are getting fair and transparent treatment from financial products and services, such as banks. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren helped create the bureau. She went to a protest outside the agency headquarters in Washington yesterday. She says President Trump and his allies have told staffers not to do any work.
Now think about this. I want you to think about this for a minute. No matter how big the scam, no matter how bold the trap, they have said, just stand by and let the Wall Street boys take your money.
The Republican staff on the Senate Banking Committee wrote online that Trump's changes will help bring responsibility back to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A big winter storm is coming to the central and eastern U.S. this morning. Winter storm advisories and warnings stretch from Texas to New Jersey. This is NPR. Federal and state health officials in Nevada are reporting a new type of bird flu has been found in a dairy worker there. This type of flu is different from the type that has been circulating recently in U.S. dairy herds. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the dairy worker had mild symptoms and has recovered. The CDC says this is the first time this type of bird flu has been traced to a cow. Science is showing that mental health and well-being change throughout the seasons, throughout the week, and even throughout the day. Emily Kwong reports on a new study from the journal BMJ Mental Health.
Across 1 million observations from 50,000 adults in the UK, gathered by the University College London, mental health and well-being tended to be better in the summer than in the winter. And on average, the group's mood was best in the morning. But if this makes you night owls shake your fists with rage, don't worry. Study author Feifei Bu knows this model does not speak for everyone everywhere.
What we focus on mostly in the study is a group trend. It's not a personal rubric.
But Bu says data like this can help mental health care providers adjust their treatments to match a patient's fluctuating needs across the day. For NPR News, I'm Emily Kwong.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is scheduled to testify this morning before the Senate Banking Committee. He is expected to be questioned about the future of short-term interest rates. Powell is scheduled to speak to a House committee tomorrow morning. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Donald Trump has announced more tariffs, this time on steel and aluminum.
Signing the order for the tariffs last night, Trump emphasized the sweeping nature of his new taxes on imports.
It's 25% without exceptions or exemptions, and that's all countries, no matter where it comes from, all countries.
NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is here to explain what's going on. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning.
So what are these tariffs and how do they compare to what Trump imposed in his first term?
Well, American importers will now be paying a 25% tax on steel and aluminum, and that makes these tariffs a lot like some you might remember him imposing during his first term, except this time the aluminum rate is higher. It was 10% back then. In doing this, the administration has stressed they're trying to use these tariffs to stick it to China, which is the world's biggest steel exporter. Now, the U.S. doesn't actually get much steel or aluminum directly from China, but the White House argues that Chinese steel makes it into the U.S. by being sold through other countries.
So you point out that China doesn't export much steel or aluminum to the U.S. What countries do export all that steel and aluminum?
Well, the U.S. gets by far the most of its aluminum imports from Canada, according to data compiled by Reuters. And on steel, Canada is also first. And there are other allies on that list, like Mexico and South Korea. You might notice that in all those countries I mentioned, Canada and Mexico feature prominently. Trump had recently threatened tariffs on them and then paused them at the last minute. Well, with this new announcement, he's putting tariffs on those two countries anyway, just not on all of their goods. And that gets to one really important thing about these tariffs. There are no exceptions to these, and that's different from Trump's tariffs last time around. It's also different from how Biden treated tariffs. Both of them had carve-outs on tariffs for some allies, but not now.
I think the big question for so many Americans are, what are these tariffs going to mean for the U.S. economy and for them?
Well, in the near term, this should be good for American steel and aluminum companies because tariffs raise the price of steel and aluminum and they protect against some foreign competition. And markets seemed to think so yesterday. Shares of Alcoa, an American aluminum company, and U.S. Steel were both up. But that doesn't mean this is great for the rest of the economy. I talked to Gary Huffbauer, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He told me that industries that use those metals, like aircraft and auto manufacturing, also bridge construction, those could lose jobs.
You lose jobs in the manufacturing sector when you put together the higher costs of inputs and the retaliation, which is sure to come, like night follows day.
He's saying there that not only would prices be higher for steel and aluminum, but other countries are likely to hit back and tariff American exports, which will hurt these companies.
Now, the president has talked about imposing still more tariffs this week. What has he said?
Well, it's unclear, but he's dribbled out a bit of information. Okay. He has said he'll be announcing what he calls reciprocal tariffs. The idea there seems to be that whatever tariff a foreign country has put on a U.S. good, he wants to impose it back in return. He also said yesterday that he'll be considering tariffs on cars, pharmaceuticals, semiconductors, but it was unclear whether those are separate from the reciprocal tariffs. And this is one constant feature of how Trump does tariff policy. There's often not an orderly rollout. We really just don't know what's coming until he says it.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you.
A federal judge in Rhode Island says the White House has defied an order to unfreeze federal grant and program funds and is ordering the administration to immediately end any federal funding pause. And this case is just one of dozens of lawsuits that have been filed to try to block some of President Trump's many executive actions that are pushing legal limits. But what if the Trump administration just ignores court rulings? To discuss this, we're joined by Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge who was appointed to the bench by President Bill Clinton. She's also consulted on a number of lawsuits that have been filed against the Trump administration. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Good morning. Good morning.
I want to ask how unusual it is with this case in Rhode Island and the judge saying his court ruling is being ignored.
Well, it's unusual that someone will have violated a rule that he just ordered, that he just put in place almost a week before. I mean, that's certainly unusual. Unusual to call out a party that is not paying attention, that is not following the rules that he's laid out. That is unusual. It doesn't happen all the time.
And obviously we don't know intent here, whether it's being ignored or just taking time to comply. But what happens if a president decides to just ignore court rulings?
A court, a judge, has tools available to him or her in the first instance. You know, they can cite the parties in front of them for contempt. They can impose fines. Of course, since one of the parties arguably here is Elon Musk, it's not clear that fines are going to make a particle of difference. There's even the possibility of imprisoning someone until the order is followed. All of these are obviously empty threats with respect to the defendants in this case. The marshals would have to enforce whatever orders the judge entered. The problem is that the marshal service is under the Department of Justice, and if Trump wanted to fully not comply, he could direct the Department of Justice not to comply. At that point, you have a full-on constitutional crisis. You have one branch of the government ignoring the legitimate orders of another branch. Let me also say the other thing available to Trump, if he doesn't agree with the judge, is to appeal. And so to some degree, hastening a constitutional crisis says something about what he's trying to do, which is more about showing his power than it is about following the law.
Now, the administration has publicly questioned the judiciary over rulings to block executive actions. We heard Vice President J.D. Vance posted on X in part that the, quote, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. Elon Musk, the owner of X, the head of Doge, an entity tasked by the administration with cutting government costs, posted on X that democracy is being destroyed by a, quote, judicial coup. Those are his words. And, of course, there was a ruling to block his team from accessing sensitive information at the Treasury. And this is what Trump had to say on the Mark Levin radio show.
It's really a shame, but judges should be ruling. They shouldn't be dictating what you're supposed to be doing.
So what's your reaction to this claim that it's actually the courts that are out of line and trying to block legitimate executive power, staging a judicial coup of some kind?
Well, the key issue is the word legitimate. The question is whether or not Trump is exercising power in a legitimate way. And when he violates the Administrative Procedure Act, which says that you can change regulations only if you follow certain procedures, when he violates the Privacy Act, threatening to release the names of the FBI agents who were arguably participated in January 6th, when he holds up the funding of programs that have been appropriated by Congress, that's the question of whether or not he's acting in a legitimate fashion. And these cases are essentially saying there's nothing remotely legitimate about what the president is doing under these circumstances. I can't emphasize enough how difficult it is for a judge to enter a temporary restraining order, which is the case in these cases. Mm. You have to find the likelihood of success on the merits, and you have to find irreparable harm. And the bar is high. It says something about how far Trump has gone from what the legitimate lawmaking function is in these cases, that judges are doing this.
Judge Nancy Gertner is a former federal judge for the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. Judge, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In Los Angeles last night, Luka Doncic made his first appearance with the Lakers. Last week, he was traded by the Dallas Mavericks to the Lakers in exchange for Anthony Davis. It was a rare move, two superstar players being traded for each other. And Laker fans are now envisioning more championships. Steve Futterman reports.
Before last night's tip-off, some fans here at the Lakers' home arena were still pinching themselves.
What was your reaction when you heard the trade?
I thought it was a joke.
J.R. Cardino is a longtime fan of both the Lakers and Luka Doncic. He has gone from disbelieving to now predicting NBA titles for the Lakers.
He's going to bring a chip. I guarantee that.
You think he'll bring a champion?
Yeah, he'll bring a chip.
Everyone attending last night's game was given a T-shirt resembling the new number 77 Laker jersey worn by Doncic. When he was introduced, a huge ovation.
From Slovenia, Luka Doncic.
Once the game began, it took him nearly 4 minutes, but on his second shot, Doncic made his first Laker basket.
Luka's got the big on him, tries the three, and has it!
In last night's game, the Lakers easily beat the Utah Jazz. Doncic, in his first game since a Christmas Day calf injury, played 23 minutes, scored 14 points. L.A. coach J.J. Redick was impressed.
You know, knowing Luka, whether he will admit this or not, like, there was probably a little bit of nerves, you know, playing for the Lakers for the first time.
In Dallas, where Doncic was the face of the franchise, there has been a great deal of anger aimed at Dallas management. There have even been some reported death threats. Complicating things is the fact that Anthony Davis is now out for several weeks after suffering an injury during his first game with the Mavericks. Doncic did not talk about the threats, but did talk about the special relationship he had with Dallas fans.
I've been there almost 7 years, and it was amazing to experience those fans and the love for me. I will always appreciate that, but now I think we should focus on the next step, and the way Lakers fans received me here was amazing.
The trade has been the talk of the basketball world. The next step is to see how well Luka Doncic will blend in with a Laker team that already features the game's all-time leading scorer, LeBron James. The Lakers have star power, still to be determined. Will that result in a serious bid for an NBA title? For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Sebastian Stan is nominated for an Oscar for his performance as Donald Trump in the film The Apprentice, and he won a Golden Globe last month for his role in A Different Man. We'll talk about his early childhood in communist Romania and his path to the U.S. and acting. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at FJC.org. From National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. natgeoexpeditions.com/cruises. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin. We are still in the age of the dating app. One swipe and you're paired up with a complete stranger. The results, often not great. So have singles given up too soon on the good old-fashioned matchmaker? There have been a few reality TV shows asking that very question. Indian matchmaking, Jewish matchmaking, and debuting today on Hulu, Muslim Matchmaker.
For Muslims, marriage is an act of worship. Many believe it's actually half your faith, because when you're in a union with someone, you have to learn who you really are.
Marriage is a blessing and a gift from God, but it's complicated and it's anxiety-inducing.
I feel like I'm obsessed with dating shows and then more obsessed with matchmaking shows, and now there's a Muslim matchmaker. I was like, it's made for me.
Good.
Like when I hear Yasmin say, flirt to convert, I was like, I have literally tried.
So have I.
Those are the hosts of Muslim Matchmaker, Huda Ibrahim and Yasmin Al-Hadi. Funny, easygoing, open-minded about finding the right match for each individual. But they have some pretty strict rules when it comes to dating. Yasmin calls them the rules of three.
3 dates, 3 months, 300 questions. And what I mean by that is that I think that by the third date, people should then decide whether to move forward with someone or not. And then I want 3 months for you to discover whether you have an emotional connection with someone or not. I love the idea of kind of transferring this no fear that we have of failure in business or in other industries to dating, and say, hey, if you're going to fail, I want you to fail fast. I really want them to explore the idea of commitment after those 3 months and say, okay, like, do you want to talk about a commitment timeline or not? And in the course of those 3 months of testing your compatibility with each other, I have 300 questions that you go through.
It's a real formula you got there.
And it's a guideline, it's a framework. And the hope with the rules of three is to kind of get out of your own head for a second and say, oh, okay, this is the way this worked for other people. Here's some wisdom behind this. It may work for me, it may not work for me, but I'm going to learn a ton about myself through this process.
When we make a match, we want people to be kind of in the same place. I'm not going to set somebody up that, like, is comfortable drinking, somebody that has never tasted alcohol. That match doesn't make sense. Halal haram ratio is not lining up. Halal is basically the things that are permissible in our faith. Haram are the things that are not permissible in our faith.
Do you think you two are what people expect when they hear Muslim matchmaker?
Hell no. No.
Exactly. Hell no.
No.
Because, like, even in the show, a few of the people are like, I got a Muslim matchmaker. And they're like, oh, my gosh, like an old auntie. And then there's, like, you two hip and fun. What is it like being an American Muslim matchmaker to other Americans? Because there's 1.9 billion Muslims in the world. So it should be easy to find one. But there's not that many in the U.S.
You know, I think Yasmin and I are so lucky because we get to bond with our clients in the sense that we've had a lot of the same experiences they have. You know, we get to relate to them. In a first-person level, you know, I've been through this, I've done this, and now I want to help you go through this.
You know, personally, me, I've gone through heartbreak, I've gone through divorce. Like, I know how hard it is.
Yeah.
It's not easy to navigate commitment in sometimes the playground of what the internet provides, or where your work environment maybe seems happier than your home environment. So we want to give people an opportunity to really be happy at home and really find solace and sakinah, as we say in our religion, which is like peace. Like the whole point of marriage is peace, and it's so that it's a platform for you to spring forward and do whatever you're supposed to do on this earth. It's not the end goal, it's just a means to get to your fullest potential.
I love that. I'm ready. No, I'm just kidding.
I love that. You're single? What?
No.
Layla.
I mean, I am.
What? Let's talk about you, girl.
So let's talk in a week. Find me. Dude, no, I'm just kidding. You kind of alluded to this, Yasmeen, but we are in the age of dating apps. Everybody's on their phone. And there's an app for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's the Salem app. Like, there's all kinds of, you're Christian, Jewish, gay, straight, all that. So what are they not getting from the apps?
I always say I want people to feel like they're chosen and that they're also able to choose. And they get to choose. And I think a part of that means you slow down and you consider one person at a time. And I think that's unfortunately not in the app culture. The app culture is next, 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 on to the next one.
Yeah.
And that can really feel like it's cheapening the entire experience. And it hits at sometimes your self-worth as well.
What do you think is going to surprise people about this show?
You know, Muslims haven't had a lot of representation in this space. And I think whenever we do, and it's related to love, it doesn't always feel authentic or genuine to the experiences that we go through. And so we really work hard to fuse, you know, our traditions and our culture with modern day dating and making it applicable for everybody, no matter your background or where you live. And I think people will definitely be surprised by that.
I think it really showcases the panoply of who we are and that we are part of this rich tapestry of the United States and that we go through the exact same things that you guys are going through out there in the world.
We're just looking for love.
And I think it helps expand people's thoughts about what a Muslim could look like and could be. You're going to also see different ideologies, different loves that they have. It's such a joyful show.
It's really fun.
And we really want people to see that Muslims are life-affirming, we're joyful, we're here, and we're not going anywhere.
Not to kill joy, but I also feel like it's coming out at a time where, like, there's really a heightened hate toward Muslims in this moment and a lot of marginalized and minority groups. Do you think it's an antidote a little bit to that? I mean, that this is something that everybody can watch.
Yeah, we hope so. We really tried to put a lot of joy on screen and hope that while people are watching this, they learn something and that they feel good and it kind of sparks joy for sure.
But I really think that the show is a peek into our world and in a way that is totally and completely without judgment, without any preconceived notions. And so it's just like an invitation to take a look and see if the way that we're doing things is what you expected or it's something that you could even actually learn from.
Huda Ibrahim and Yasmeen Al-Hadi are the co-hosts of Muslim Matchmaker, now streaming on Hulu. Thank you to you both.
Thank you so much, Layla. This was amazing.
Thank you, Layla. I'm feeling like a new man, like I got a new plan, and I can finally see.
It's always been in front of me, yeah. So pay attention, you might learn a thing or two. This is NPR News.
Hearings to confirm Linda McMahon as Secretary of Education begin this week in the Senate. Some critics say she doesn't have the education experience for the job. Others argue that isn't necessary.
The Department of Education is not a school. It's a bank. It's an advocate. It's a policy shop.
Hear more about who Linda McMahon is on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump meets with Jordan's King Abdullah today at the White House. Their talks come a week after Trump suggested the U.S. take over Gaza and Jordan and Egypt take in Palestinians displaced by the war between Israel and Hamas. NPR's Jaina Raff in Amman says the Jordanian government has said no to Trump's plan.
The Jordanian foreign minister, Ayman al-Safadi, has quite clearly said that expulsion of Palestinians here would be a breach of its historic peace treaty with Israel and therefore seen as a declaration of war.
Trump is threatening to cut U.S. aid to Jordan and Egypt if the two countries don't agree to take in Palestinians. A recent poll by CBS News shows 53% of Americans approve of how President Trump is handling his job. A Pew survey shows Trump's job approval at 47%. Political strategist Sarah Longwell publishes the conservative website The Bulwark. She says Trump's flurry of executive actions are being seen positively by much of the public, even if many don't understand the details or whether something is legal.
But what they see is action, and I think relative to Joe Biden, who people saw very little of toward the end of his presidency, I think just the sheer movement of all of it makes people feel like something is happening, which they feel good about.
This is NPR News. Ecuador's conservative incumbent president will once again face off against a leading leftist rival after failing to secure a majority in yesterday's national elections. As NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, the results reflect a nation divided over how best to fix the country's economy, energy problems, and record crime.
Ecuador's young leader, Daniel Noboa, took to social media to thank supporters for giving him the edge in yesterday's contest. With nearly all the votes counted, the 37-year-old president won a little more than 44% of the vote. His rival, 47-year-old lawyer Luisa Gonzalez, called the race a statistical tie. She earned more than 43% of ballots cast. Since President Noboa took office, he's launched a crackdown on Ecuador's gangs and international traffickers fighting for control over the nation's lucrative ports to ship drugs to Europe and the U.S. He says he needs more time for his iron fist approach to work. Gonzalez, who has ties to former leftist leaders, says more help for the poor and economic development will curb crime. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
Authorities in Arizona say one person was killed and several injured yesterday when a private jet landing at the airport in Scottsdale veered off a runway and hit a parked plane. The arriving jet is owned by Motley Crue singer Vince Neil. His representative says Neil was not on the jet at the time. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Some of the key functions of the U.S. Education Department are being eliminated, such as conducting research about U.S. schools and colleges and the millions of students who attend them. This is some of the work done by the Institute of Education Sciences, but employees of the department tell NPR that many of the contracts IES oversees have now ended. NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta has been following the story. So before we get to what you're hearing from your sources about these latest cuts, what exactly does IES do?
The Institute is responsible for overseeing a lot of the data that tells us everything from how students are doing in school to what teaching methods best work to educate students, enrollment data, school choice programs, just a massive swath of research that shapes how the education system works. IES supports school districts, state agencies, and educators who then take this data and put it to work in classrooms and beyond.
Okay, now to the cuts. What are you hearing about the kinds of cuts being made?
Yeah, I spoke to two employees of IES. They didn't want to be named because they fear losing their jobs. They both told me that Monday afternoon, they got an email from IES managers calling for an emergency meeting. And in that meeting, they were told that most of IES's contracts were going to be canceled based on guidance from the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, as most people know it now. That's the unit within the Trump administration that's being run by Elon Musk. IES heavily relies on contractors to do what it does. So without these contractors, that work is essentially halted. The employees I spoke to said the mood in that meeting was somber and some were holding back tears. And one of the workers said all the contracts that they oversee were already canceled by the end of the workday. So they and their colleagues are really wondering what this means for their jobs.
Can you tell us like an example of one of the programs that might be threatened now?
So another source my colleague Corey Turner spoke to has extensive knowledge of many of these contracts we're talking about. For example, they said there's some high quality digital tools that are already being used in classrooms in many states to measure how kids can make up ground in math. It's part of a study that IES was conducting, and now that that contract is canceled, the study is going to be cut short and the tools could soon be pulled from classrooms. This source called these cuts, quote, the destruction of knowing what works for kids. And the Department of Education got back to me late last night, linking to a post on X by DOGE that basically confirmed that DOGE has cut dozens of contracts worth millions of dollars.
So, okay, government efficiency is actually in the name of that unit, DOGE. Could these cuts make the government more efficient?
President Trump said over the weekend efforts like these across the federal government will save billions, but one IES employee put it this way. DOGE wants to make the government more efficient, but the government just wasted millions of dollars today by cutting these contracts. And I want to add, some of the research conducted by IES is mandated by Congress, and it's not clear how those programs will be affected.
So now I'm wondering, Janaki, what this means for our understanding of the education system in the United States.
That's the big question. I spoke to a couple of researchers who say that they and their colleagues are furiously downloading data from IES because they're afraid the whole website could go dark and decades of data could become really hard to access. And moving forward, we just don't know what will happen to this research. Once these contracts are scrapped, they can't just be restarted. There's a long bureaucratic process to get them up and running.
NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For several years now, nuclear power has been trying to make a comeback in the U.S. The Biden administration liked nuclear's low carbon footprint, and President Trump has cited nuclear as part of his plan to, quote, unleash American energy. All of this is adding pressure to the decades-long effort to find a place to store the radioactive waste U.S. nuclear power plants produce. Scott Franz with member station KUNC has more.
The Wild Goose is a cozy coffee shop tucked inside an old grain elevator in the tiny town of Hayden in sparsely populated northwest Colorado. A coal-fired power plant towering over this community is closing soon, and people are urgently pondering Hayden's future.
There's a lot of great minds working together to figure some of the impacts out, because the impacts are huge.
Tammy Delaney and her husband Patrick own this gathering spot, and they're trying to help their town transition. They recently converted old grain warehouses into short-term rentals and a hip wine bar. The last fall, the Delaney started hearing about a much bigger idea, replacing the dying coal industry with nuclear energy. Patrick is intrigued.
There's a lot of great things about nuclear power. It's efficient, it's on. I mean, a pellet the size of your thumbnail has the same energy content as 1,000 pounds of coal. It's amazing.
But they also have concerns. To help facilitate the push for nuclear energy, an economic development group here is floating the idea of building a temporary storage site for the radioactive spent fuel produced by U.S. nuclear power plants. Large concrete and steel canisters of the spent fuel would be loaded on specially reinforced trucks and trains and brought to a warehouse far from people. It wouldn't be in Hayden, but the Delaneys fear regional impacts.
Obviously, a lot of concerns with transporting nuclear waste by rail.
Right now, nuclear plants store their waste on site. The federal government has been trying to find a single place for them to send it since 1970. In 2021, Congress set aside money to identify places that might be open to building a temporary storage site. An economic development group here, looking for something to replace the coal industry, responded. Last fall, it introduced the concept at a series of low-key meetings. Matt Solomon is the project manager.
There's an opportunity to set up a whole new energy-related industry in this region of our state and secure some of the jobs, some of the homes and the families in this area.
A few months ago, Solomon's group won a federal grant to start local discussions about maybe siting an interim waste storage facility here.
It's not the Simpsons with bubbling green fluid. It's concrete casks with eraser tip pieces of metal that are cooling down.
Other grantees include Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Eastern Kentucky, and Carlsbad, New Mexico. It's early. Solomon's talks are just getting started, but the waste storage idea is getting mixed reactions deep in Colorado's coal country. Sasha Nelson is driving me around her small hometown of Craig that's also losing a coal-fired power plant. Her job is to help the area transition away from coal. She calls the talks about nuclear development critical to assess the options for the future, but
it would break my heart if, because of our remoteness, we're a waste disposal area.
The U.S. Department of Energy is asking communities that want to keep talking about hosting a temporary waste site to say so this fall. It hopes to open a facility by 2038. For NPR News, I'm Scott Franz.
This is NPR News.
The tornado of executive actions from the Trump administration has left many Americans uncertain and afraid. How fear works in American politics, next time on Here and Now.
NPR is on the radio, online, and at your fingertips, wherever you go. Stay connected. Take the news with you on your smartphone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, me Martinez. How many snakes is too many snakes? The thought of one is just too much for me. Well, a couple in Sydney, Australia recently found over 100 venomous snakes in their backyard. The company Reptile Relocation Sydney says the homeowners called them because they saw, quote, a couple of red-bellied snakes coming in and out of a mulch pile. When the snake catchers arrived, they pulled 102 snakes out, 5 adults, 97 newborn babies. Talk about getting it twisted. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station
And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. People of South Asian origin are more likely to be affected by heart disease, but their risks often go unnoticed. Researchers are looking to genetics to better understand heart disease in South Asians and prevent early deaths. Priyanka Dayal McCluskey from member station WBUR reports.
Food has always been a passion for Pushpir Petya, the chef and owner of an Indian restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Of course, Indian food, pizza, I love sandwiches.
Petya is 53. He says he tries to eat healthy and exercise, but like a lot of South Asian people, heart disease runs in his family.
My daughters, they'll say, Dad, make sure you do good. You know, we want you to be around as much as possible, right?
So Petya met with Dr. Sarju Ganatra, a cardiologist at Leahy Hospital in Burlington, Massachusetts. He told the doctor that his uncle and his father died of heart problems.
My father passed away with a cardiac arrest.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And my dad's older brother also passed away with a cardiac arrest.
Okay.
So that's why I thought, like, you know, it's better that I should do this preventive care thing.
Right.
Ganatra leads the hospital's South Asian cardiometabolic program. The goal is preventing heart disease in people whose families originate from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other South Asian countries. Ganatra says genetics is one undeniable reason why South Asians are more likely to develop heart disease and suffer heart attacks at younger ages.
South Asians have genetic factors which leads to some of the very high-risk features for developing blockages in the blood vessels.
Routine tests can miss some clues, like elevated levels of a cholesterol called lipoprotein A. Ganatra often orders additional blood tests or imaging to get a better picture of what's happening inside his patient's arteries and whether they need to make lifestyle changes or take medications like statins.
If we don't identify the risk properly, we can't prevent it properly.
Efforts like this targeting South Asian patients have been growing, driven by some stark numbers. Researchers estimate that South Asians make up 25% of the world's population, but account for 60% of heart disease. South Asians are also underrepresented in scientific research compared to their share of the population. Dr. Pradeep Natarajan, a cardiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, is co-leading a study that aims to correct this by analyzing the DNA of South Asian people living across the U.S.
We have not had the data sets, really substantive data sets, to really study this.
Natarajan's team is working to map out the genetic factors that put South Asians at greater risk.
If we have data sets that are large enough, we might find actually unique genes or unique gene regions or unique genetic mechanisms that might be particularly relevant in this population. It won't explain all of it, but it'll begin to unpack really critical and important reasons.
Natarajan is hopeful this research could lead to new treatments for the many South Asian people who might benefit, and for anyone at risk of heart disease. For NPR News, I'm Priyanka Dayal McCluskey in Boston.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Ongoing scientific research could be affected by the Trump administration's recent changes across the federal government. Last week, the National Institutes of Health abruptly changed its funding rules for scientific research, prompting chaos and uncertainty for scientific researchers everywhere, including in cancer research. Yesterday, a federal judge granted an injunction after 22 state attorneys general sued to stop the new rules, so that's a temporary pause on these cuts. NPR's Yuki Noguchi joins us now to discuss how these changes could affect patients. Yuki, so what's happened as a result of this move by NIH?
You know, it touched off a huge amount of concern among cancer researchers and institutions that rely on federal funds to run experiments or, you know, clinical trials. You know, this rule wouldn't affect the research monies itself, but a related thing called indirect costs, you know, overhead, basically, money for things like laboratories and equipment or software that researchers need to conduct their experiments. And many researchers, universities and cancer centers relying on those funds say that within weeks or months, they would have to cut some programs. You know, they rely on that money to keep mice in labs alive and keep clinical trials with patients going. But Dr. Kimran Rathmel, who directed the National Cancer Institute until last month under Biden, says there could be immediate impact.
Some of those trials aren't going to open, and there are some patients out there who are going to get that news.
And, you know, clinical trials are often for the sickest patients for whom medicines are no longer working. So that's why it would be a very bad effect for them.
All right. So that's one immediate effect, but stretched out over time. What else might it affect?
Yeah, Rathmel says research creates people with depth of knowledge that benefit all patients. Like, for instance, you know, she's a kidney cancer expert and often shared her expertise.
I would talk to community people all the time about how I was choosing between these different drugs and what I might do if I had a patient like theirs.
You know, and with less research, she argues you have fewer people in the country like her to turn to for advice like that.
What was the NIH leadership's goal in cutting this funding rate?
Yeah, I mean, they say the goal is not to create chaos in medical research, but to force some overhead cost cutting because, you know, they say those rates are too high. These indirect costs universities collect can be as much as 60% on top of what the researcher gets as part of their grant. And Jay Green, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, is a supporter of this change, and he argues those rates aren't justified, and he wants more private money to fund cancer research instead. And when I asked him whether he supports the abruptness of this change, you know, he said it was a way to force things.
Significant pressure helps them be more creative.
Green also says he does not think it will affect patient care either.
Patients should be completely not alarmed. This is a dispute over the overhead costs between university bureaucrats and taxpayers.
All right, so a federal judge has paused these rules. So when were they supposed to take effect?
You know, immediately. But like many of the Trump administration's early moves, now we'll be watching a court case and whether the NIH complies with any ruling.
All right, that's NPR's Yuki Noguchi. Thanks a lot, Yuki.
Thank you.
In novels like Jitterbug Perfume, the writer Tom Robbins dazzled readers with colorful characters and effusive language. He died over the weekend at 92. Tom Vitale has this appreciation.
Tom Robbins lived in Washington State most of his life, but he was born in rural North Carolina and moved around the South. In 2014, Robbins told NPR that as a boy, he would tell stories aloud to himself, outside, with a stick in his hand.
And I would beat the ground as I told the story. And we moved fairly frequently. We would leave houses behind where one section of the yard was completely bare from where I destroyed the grass. But I realized much later in life that what I was doing was drumming. I was building a rhythm.
By the time Robbins started writing novels in his 30s, the stick was gone, but the rhythm was stronger than ever.
Jelly is sitting in the outhouse. She's been sitting there longer than necessary. The door is wide open and lets in the sky, or rather, a piece of the sky.
In this excerpt from the audiobook of his novel, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, we meet the boss of an old lesbian ranch in deep contemplation.
What looks to be a wisp of cloud is actually the moon, narrow and pale like a paring snipped from a snowman's toenail.
Robbins wrote in his memoir that he began taking LSD in 1964, and the eccentric characters and bizarre situations in his novels reflect a hallucinatory vision. In his first book, Another Roadside Attraction, the mummified body of Jesus Christ turns up at a roadside hot dog stand. His novel, Still Life with Woodpecker, takes place inside a pack of Camel cigarettes.
People who believed that he was a drug-taking bon vivant that wasn't particularly serious in his work actually don't pay attention to the profound nature underneath that humor.
Professor Catherine Heuser wrote a study guide to the novels of Tom Robbins. She says underneath the fantasy and whimsy, Robbins was an advocate for feminism, social justice, and the environment. She singles out his 1994 novel, Half Asleep in Frog Pajamas, in which frogs are disappearing.
And he was writing about this well before people were even noticing about the decline of species on our planet from climate change.
Amid the humor and wild imagination in his prose, Robbins embedded small essays on subjects ranging from the life of an amoeba to Eastern philosophy. What made it all work were his meticulously crafted sentences.
Weather's hot, but there's a breeze today, and it feels sweet, swimming up her bare thighs. There is sage smell and rose waft. There is fly buzz and polka yip. Way off, horse lips flutter.
Even Cowgirls Get the Blues and Robbins' other books have been translated into more than 20 languages. They sold millions of copies. Tom Robbins said that language was the most important thing. It was more important, he said, than the message. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.